When he called the police that night, he said he was playing video games in the basement when an intruder shot his entire family. He just happened to know where the gun was discarded down the street, and he just happened to text his girlfriend that he was a really good shot. This is the story of Mason Sisk, the 14-year-old who killed his family because he was fed up with them. Hi friends, I'm Katie, and this is Katie Does Crime. Thank you for joining me for the first time if you're new here, and hello to the usual rapscallions and reprobates. Please consider subscribing or joining me on Patreon if you'd like to hear more true crime stories. Our case begins in Elkmont, Alabama, a tiny town near the Tennessee border. 14-year-old Mason Wayne Sisk called 911 late on September 2nd, 2019. It was between 10:30 and 11 p.m., and he said he was freaking out. His story was that he was playing a video game in the basement when he heard 5 gunshots. He ran upstairs and found that his entire family had been killed. His dad, John Wayne, 38, adoptive stepmother, Mary, 35, his brother, Grayson, called Kane, 6, his sister, Aurora, called Rory, 4, and his brother, Colson, 6 months old. He said he heard someone run outside before he found that every single member of his immediate family had a gunshot to the head. He didn't see the getaway car, but said it sounded like a Chevy. Mason was waiting in a car in the driveway when the police arrived. Inside the house, they found Mason's father naked in bed and still attached to his CPAP machine, but he was just barely alive. So was the older of the 2 brothers. They were both flown to the hospital, but sadly died shortly thereafter. The daughter had died in her bed, and a pillow had been placed over her face. The stepmother was dead, and her baby had died cradled next to her. Baby Colson had been shot from only about 12 inches away. He would later be buried in his mother's arms. It didn't take long for investigators to question Mason's story. One of the deputies said in the body cam footage, "Either that little boy is completely traumatized by what he's just seen, or he's going to be a suspect. He's acting completely weird." The details just didn't add up for the authorities. Such as, how did he know to say that all 5 family members had been shot when they couldn't find the baby? He wasn't discovered in his mother's arms until paramedics arrived later. And why was Mason standing around telling the deputies his story rather than urging them inside to help his family? They put Mason in a patrol car and took him to the sheriff's office for an interview. And I don't know if he just wasn't up to the lie anymore or if he had come down from a mental break, but he quickly gave in and confessed. He told them where he had thrown the gun on the side of a nearby road. He had signed a Miranda waiver saying he was willing to answer questions without an adult in the room. Mason was taken to the Tennessee Valley Juvenile Detention Center where he was evaluated for mental and physical abnormalities. A probation officer said he seemed perfectly normal and only got in trouble there for talking without permission. However, because his crimes were so serious, the officer recommended that Mason be tried as an adult. A judge agreed that Mason should be tried in the adult court system, and the boy was locked up in county jail in November 2020. After he'd been sitting around for over a year with no movement in the case, Mason's lawyer filed a motion to get him a speedy trial, his Sixth Amendment right. On January 27, 2021, formal paperwork was filed to indict Mason on capital murder charges. He was now 16 years old. Mason's initial trial was moved around due to a judge retiring, then discussions of his mental competence to stand trial, and then Mason filing for a new lawyer. And I don't exactly blame him for that one. His existing lawyer decided to run for district attorney. You know, when the office of the district attorney was the one prosecuting Mason. It was surely a conflict of interest. While all of this was going on, some new evidence against Mason came out thanks to one of the court filings. Mason had allegedly threatened his parents and couldn't control his anger with his brothers and sister. He stole rings from his stepmom and took a gun from his grandmother. And worst of all, he put peanut butter in his stepmom's coffee while knowing that she had a severe peanut allergy. But Mason's lawyers countered that he had been abused as a small child in a sexual way and was a victim of physical abuse as well. They said that he had been locked away and ignored by his alcoholic birth mother, who was only part of his life until he was 3. She died in 2011, and worst of all, one family member says Mason didn't even realize his adoptive stepmom wasn't his real mother until recently. Then he was also bullied in school, exposed to violence from all sides. His defense team hoped that this would explain how he came to be a killer, in the hope of getting him a lighter sentence if he was to eventually be found guilty. Mason first went to trial in September 2022. The 16-year-old, who had been his girlfriend at the time of the murders, took the stand and was read some of their old text messages. She had asked him, "Did you do it?" And he said, "Yes." She asked why, and he said, "I did it because I was forced to. I was held at gunpoint, and if I didn't, I would die." He was saying that a man in a mask had made him kill his family to spare his own life, although, of course, he had told police that he never saw the supposed murderer who ran from the house and left in what sounded like a Chevy. He also texted this girlfriend that he wanted to become a contract killer, saying, "I am good with a gun. I killed my family in less than 4 seconds. All headshots." Between these texts and his taped confession, things didn't look good for Mason. However, that trial ended quickly when Mason's attorneys motioned for a mistrial. The FBI had Mason's parents' phone in their possession, but cracking an unlock code can take between 2 and 26 years. It just so happened that his stepmom's phone was able to be unlocked in the middle of the trial. And now with this new evidence available to them, Mason's attorneys wanted time to properly review the messages. The DA said in response, "Evidence came up, whether it's for him or for us. I would hate to have somebody where we tried a case, we get a defendant convicted, and then all of a sudden they crack open the phone, and then there's something on that phone that would exonerate them." He said it was disappointing that the trial couldn't continue, but that the most important thing to him is that every defendant gets a fair trial. Mason's second trial began in April 2023. It only lasted 9 days, partly because the defense didn't call any witnesses. They didn't call Mason, and they weren't allowed by the judge to call an expert on forced confessions. However, there were 31 prosecution witnesses. Prosecutors argued that Mason was clearly guilty because he called his girlfriend 4 times before he ever called 911. And worse still, during his interview with police, he never asked if anyone in the family was still alive. He didn't show any concern for them. Prosecutors said his reason for killing his family was that he was quote-unquote fed up with them. Fed up with his dad and stepmom fighting, and fed up with having to do chores, and fed up with his dad being drunk, and fed up with his phone being taken away for arguing with his parents. In his confession, Mason said he didn't want his brothers and sister growing up in that kind of household. Prosecutors called a teacher to the stand who had worked with Mason's stepmother at the school for a little while and had become a friend. She said Mason told her at the start of the school year that he wouldn't be in school the following week. In retrospect, it seemed like he must have plotted the murders ahead of time. The teacher had seen him sitting alone at school and wished him good luck for the new semester, and he'd said, "It's not going to matter. I'm not going to be here next week." The teacher said something had been off about him, and she felt disturbed by it. Under cross-examination, she said that John, Mason's dad, didn't usually have a job, and that Mary, Mason's stepmother, was the one to support the family. She said John was controlling and degrading to Mary, that he'd made weird comments to Mary in front of her. She called John more than mean and said she was surprised they were still married. He had pleaded guilty to sexual misconduct with a minor in 1999. Also on the stand was a family friend who said his 9mm pistol mysteriously disappeared from his bedside table the weekend before the murders. Only he and his wife and the Sisk family were in the home that weekend, and they all searched everywhere for the gun, even Mason. The serial number of the blood-spattered gun in evidence, the one used in the shootings, matched his gun. The friend's wife described Mason as quiet, but fine and respectful. She said he played with his brother and sister that weekend at their house as usual. The jury was shown photos of the victims on the night of the murders, along with their autopsy photos. Mason didn't look at the photos as they were shown, only rubbed his head and looked away. But maybe that would make sense if he was innocent. Who wants to see photos of their brutally murdered family?
And the prosecution shown a number of crime scene photos and autopsy photos, and you've really given good detail into why they've shown those and what it could mean. And it sounds like the defense, you know, like you said, has given details of his home life and why this possibly couldn't be premeditated or him or, you know. So what does that evidence, how big of a role does that evidence play in a case like this?
I think any of us are put in a situation where we're suddenly asked to decide the fate of somebody. Somebody says, "Look, this is what they did." And they show you 15 or 20 pictures of a 6-month-old who's been shot in the head twice, or a, you know, 6-year-old or a 4-year-old or a mother and a father. I think on some level, you're going to see that picture more than you're going to hear other things. So it has I imagine a lot of people, a unique emotional weight in terms of how you view this defendant and how you view this case. And so there was a lot of fighting about how many pictures the state should be allowed to show. Why not 2 or 3? Why 20? But it's 20 of the same terrible thing. And, you know, as Dallas reported yesterday, jurors were crying, family members, people in the courtroom were crying. You're talking about really graphic, really terrible photos. And that's clearly going to weigh on the jury's mind as they sift through the evidence.
And how did Mason react?
Dallas's reporting was that he was pretty stoic. He didn't react much at all. It's hard to know how to read that. I'm not sure it's my role or Dallas's role to read it. He just didn't show much emotion. I've seen cases where somebody's charged with killing family members or shooting up a classroom. Amy Bishop at the UH shooting put her head on the desk when they were showing the crime scene photos. She wouldn't look at it. Mark Stone, who's charged with killing his wife and his son, the camera, the screen was near his face, and he just kind of turned away the entire time. I mean, there's no way for us to know what somebody's thinking in that moment, but it's the vivid reminder of the, you know, most terrible situation you can find yourself in, and here it is, and they're pointing to you as the person responsible for it.
Mason's lawyers argue that he was being wrongfully accused and that authorities didn't investigate other potential suspects because they were so hung up on Mason. Deputies also didn't read Mason his Miranda rights for over 2 hours when they first arrived at the house. His lawyers said there was no way he committed the crimes because he didn't have firearms training. Of course, he did know how to use a BB gun. But they said he didn't leave a manifesto like so many teenage killers do. His defense team said his confession on the night of the murders to police was coerced. Of course, prosecutors argued that Mason wasn't being interrogated at the time of his confession. Authorities were just asking questions to understand what happened. They said he had never been pressured to confess, and he wasn't being detained there at the house on the night of the murders because they didn't consider him a suspect at that moment. It's a little hard to say that he wasn't in custody, though, when they had put handcuffs on him before taking him to a patrol car, and you can hear police telling him he's being detained in the body cam footage. But the only things really working in Mason's favor were these three: the empty backpack, the drugs, and the questions about paternity. On the day the gun went missing from the family friend's house, Mason went into their bathroom with his backpack. The wife searched through his bag when he emerged, but there was no gun. Of course, the wife admitted that they should have patted him down or called the police. And when her husband was on the stand, he said that Mason's dad was a member of a motorcycle club and had a past burglary charge. He had a stash of drugs in the house at one time, but Mason's stepmom called the cops to get rid of them. So there was someone out there that he owed money to for those lost drugs, the implication being that maybe someone came to collect their pound of flesh. He said that during the weekend they were all together and the gun went missing, Mason's dad wasn't acting like himself, that he seemed worried and would just stare into the distance. But if he owed someone money, it didn't make sense that nothing had been taken from the house, including $300 left in Mason's dad's wallet. And maybe most interesting of all, there was a rumor that Mason's dad had some fear that his youngest son might not actually be his. He thought his brother, who was also implicated in that past burglary charge, might be the father. The adult brothers looked alike, so it was hard to tell, but just the thought bothered him. Mason's dad didn't interact with the baby much. And of course, that baby was the only person in the family who had been shot twice. But no one knew about Mason's stepmom ever cheating, and of course, how would the brother have gotten the gun to shoot everyone with? He wasn't there the weekend that everyone was visiting the family friends and the gun went missing. And of course, Mason had known where to point the cops to find the gun on the side of the road nearby. If some intruder had done the murders, how did Mason know the gun had been discarded and where? After 7 days of witness testimony, the jury only deliberated for less than 2 hours. The defense urged them to consider reasonable doubt, but the state asked them to just use common sense. On April 27, 2023, Mason was found guilty on 4 counts of capital murder. One reporter said that as the verdict was read, he looked a bit shell-shocked. The judge wrote that the murders were ghastly, disturbing, and draped in unmitigated evil. But Mason's lawyer said that the important information wasn't allowed to be brought up in court and that this case will definitely have to be tried again.
He's disappointed. He's hurting. He's struggling. Obviously doesn't visually emote very well. But, I mean, we've been working side by side with him for a long time, and you can tell that he was upset. He was hopeful that he might be given the opportunity, at least throughout whatever sentence he ends up serving, that he has the ability to change, and Mike could even earn consideration to show that he's changed. We do remain hopeful that an appellate consideration might provide him that hope.
Despite the apparently easy decision on the part of the jury, the judge didn't want to rush into sentencing. Though life without parole is the usual sentence for a capital murder case like this in Alabama, the judge said that the court needed to hear from loved ones both for and against Mason's freedom. Remaining family members and friends made statements, and then the DA recommended life in prison without the possibility of parole. Because Mason was so young at the time of the murders, he wasn't being considered for the death penalty. On September 7th, 2023, just after the fourth anniversary of the murders, 18-year-old Mason was sentenced, as expected, to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The judge said that despite Mason's tender age at the time of the killings, the fact that these poor people had been shot while they slept made the situation particularly appalling. As the sentence was read, Mason sat still with no reaction but to sigh. He also chose not to say anything, no apology to his remaining family or the community. But the district attorney had plenty to say. He released a statement that said, "When we go to bed at night and lock our doors and turn on our alarm systems, Mason Sisk is what we are afraid of. When your children get up in the middle of the night and they're scared because there's a monster under the bed or there's a monster in the closet, Mason Sisk is what they are afraid of. In this case, Mason Sisk is the monster who was in the basement and waited for these children to fall asleep, and he put a bullet in their heads and killed them. I've done this for a long time, too long. I've prosecuted a lot of people in my career, and I can tell you that of all of those people, only 4 or 5 people scare the hell out of me, and he's at the top of my list. Mason Sisk is clearly one of the most dangerous people who will ever be sentenced in Limestone County." With this sentence today, Judge Wise has ensured that Mason Sisk will never threaten another child's safety and well-being. Judge Wise has removed the monster from our society and has ensured that our children and our children's children will be safe from Mason Sisk. Justice has been served. Now it is time for us to shut the door on Mason Sisk and forget him. Of course, Mason's defense attorney is more sympathetic. He says, "I know that Mason's disappointed. It's difficult. He emotes in his way, and he doesn't have anyone to really help him with that." So the question remains, if this was a kid who had been neglected and needed care and therapy for his trauma, or if this was a monster who can't be rehabilitated and needs to spend his life behind bars, or maybe it's a little bit of both. No matter what the case is, we remember John Sisk, who worked on cars and had been a barber. After Hurricane Katrina forced her to move, John met his future wife in Indiana and then followed her down to Alabama to start their new life together. We remember Mary Sisk, a fifth-generation teacher working in special education who was about to start her PhD while raising 4 kids. Her former special needs student showed up to her funeral and said things like, "If it wasn't for Mrs. Sisk, I wouldn't have graduated high school. If it wasn't for Mrs. Sisk, I wouldn't have learned to read." And we remember their children, Kane, Rory, and Colson, who will never grow up to be what they were meant to be. Mason's grandmother said that her only comfort is that they're now in death what they were in life, together.
We're hoping that Mason will get the help he needs. We're still flabbergasted, you know, of course. But you can't just turn off unconditional love.
Thank you for tuning into my podcast episode. I'm just a true crime fan like you are, and I really appreciate you taking a chance on me. Please subscribe and tell a friend if you like spending this time together. You can also find me on YouTube in the flesh by searching Katie Does Crime.